I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And there really is a God. I didn't win those pretzels. I've been flying across the country today and savoring the wonderful American Airlines pretzels. And those look disgustingly similar to what and the man with 44 years was the guy that took the bacon home. Better him than me. delighted to see you. My name is Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. And a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And you know where that is. So it wouldn't be any point in me telling you. Good to see you. Oh, I thought we had some hand jive going on or something. Yeah, I want to get in on it. It was great to see a bunch of old friends here. And got some buddies down from what I understand to be the sobriety capital of the world, Beaverton, Oregon. That was unanimously the vote of the Beaverton, Oregon AA members. And lots of good buddies here. So it feels like home, and I am delighted to be here. Thanks to Marcia. I thought Marcia was going to talk for a long time, so I was sitting there just having a good time listening to an Al-Anon trying to tell the truth. And first thing I knew, she quit right midstream. What I want to do is tell you some of my story. I would tell it all, but I'm afraid y'all would quit. And I swear, I always like to quit just a couple minutes before you do. That's the loneliest feeling. You ever been talking to a group? And I'll tell you, there's nobody needs to announce it, but you just know when it happens, you come to a point and you're just done. You're done. And I don't know what it is, but it looks like kind of a film drops over folks' eyes. You talk on all you want to, but you're done. I mean, you might as well go home. So I've kind of learned to beat that by a couple of minutes. So don't get goggle-eyed on me now, because I think it's quitting time. And so I'm going to try to get ahead of that just a little bit. I will tell you as much as I can in the time we have. I really would like to talk a lot of program stuff. I've been very blessed in that I got sort of nudged into Alcoholics Anonymous a long, long time ago. And I attended my first meeting February the 2nd of 1957. And thank you very much. And by the amazing grace of God that I haven't had a drink since. And that's a tremendous miracle. I'll absolutely assure you that I never intended to stay sober this long, that's for sure. That would have scared me to death if somebody had told you, you know where you'll be almost 48 years down the road, dry as a bone. And sure enough, it works. The only thing I saw is that several folks getting in here knew. I just warned you about one thing. Be careful, even if they let you win all that stuff. Man, they let you win along a little bit, and then they'll just close the cage, and you'll never get out. I mean, you got to get out while you can. I hope very much that you'll stay here for a long, long time. And I'm a guy that I have alcoholism. I don't know a lot about it. It's just alcoholism happens to folks, and you know, whether it's physical or mental or epidemiological or biological, physiological, sociological. I don't know what it is. It's not even logical, to tell you the truth. But it just happens. And I don't know that much about it. I know what I hear, and I believe it, is that 1 out of 10 folk who drink have it. And 9 out of 10 don't. And I don't know what is it makes us get the lucky raffle ticket that catch it. But I was one of those. I was one of those people for whom, I tell you what I've come to believe. Now, this is pretty heavy stuff. You may want to get the folks over to university to research this. But what I've come to believe is that there are two things that are essential for alcoholism to occur. One is a predisposed personality. You just got to sort of be set up so that booze has an exaggerated importance to us. I believe that. The other thing is alcohol. I've never met an alcoholic who didn't drink. And most of them quite a lot. Well, there are a whole bunch of theories about this stuff. I won't go into many of them. I'll just tell you one that kind of appeals to me. There's some empirical evidence, I guess, that alcoholics just seem to be of a little keener level of intelligence than average people. That we have a quality of creativity and dynamic energy in the brain that just surpasses average mortals. And some notion that the alcoholic brain is even bigger than that of average folk. Well, I've heard these theories all my life, but the only place I've ever heard them discussed was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if any of those are true or not. I tell you the most important thing that I know about alcoholism. That's that I have it. I have it. And I have absolutely, whatever it is, I have absolutely no question that I have it. And I've had it, I wasn't born with it, but I developed it fairly early in life. I was a guy that, when I started to drink, booze had it did have an exaggerated importance for me. It did something special. I've never had an unimportant drink in my life. Not a one. And I don't think I've ever turned one down. At least if I turned one down, I didn't understand the question. I don't remember turning one down. So I always just had a sort of a above average interest in booze because it just did a lot for me. Man, it gave me a sense of well-being and confidence that I could fit into any crowd, take them over if I drink enough. And so it was my natural kind of a thing. And so I started to drink what the untrained eye would call too much. I never did feel like I drank too much. Drank all I could hold, sometimes a little more than I could hold. You ever had it just run over? I mean, I'm not talking about throwing up. Man, you ever have it just run over and come out your nose? Jesus. That smarts. That really smarts. And I've done that. I just sort of had that exaggerated kind of a value for alcohol. And so it always was important to me. And I drank an awful lot. Well, if you drink a lot, you're going to have an interesting life. And my history is replete with a lot of just, good God, name it, fiascos and misadventures and goof-ups and blunders and some frivolity, but I swear it was just a pure mess. And that history was something else. I was a guy that drank heavily from the very beginning. I had a lot of the problems associated with alcoholism before I was alcoholic. And I'm one who believes that just excessive drinking doesn't connote alcoholism. You know, it's just pigs, I guess. I mean, I was just a pig about alcohol. And I drank a lot of booze before I was alcoholic. And when you drink a lot of booze, strange things happen. Yeah, I went to jail before I was alcoholic. Wrecked cars, you know, lost jobs. Did all of the stuff, gagged a lot. Did all of the stuff that was normally associated with alcoholic behavior before I was alcoholic. And so I had a kind of a ragged career right from the beginning. I fell in love with drinking as a way of life. I loved the party scene. I loved cool, dark caves that they call lounges. Loved smoky jazz clubs with that smoke so blue and thick you could cut it with a knife. And hear some old throaty sax growling away over that sucker. I could have stayed there forever. Except they tended to throw me out a lot. I was tended to interrupt the music a lot. But I just loved that kind of stuff. And I'll let you in on a little secret. I'd be doing that tonight. Except for one small troubling thing. I developed alcoholism. Now, I didn't know it when I developed alcoholism because I think I was quite drunk at the time. But something happened that I really don't understand. We describe it in AA as crossing a line from that kind of wild, crazy, recreational, celebrational drinking into a different kind of drinking called alcoholism. And the nature of alcoholism is that if I take a drink of anything with alcohol in it, I cannot predict what I'll do. If I take a drink, I can't predict how much I'll drink, what I'll drink, what I'll do when I drink, or how long I'll drink. Now, I certainly was not really aware of that when I slipped over that line. I really didn't notice it. I didn't recognize it till I was sober in AA and looked back, and I could see where there was through sober eyes, a very clear distinction between that wild, crazy drinking and then the kind that knew no end. And so when I developed alcoholism, I was the kind of guy who didn't stop because it was a good thing to do. I don't remember ever stopping with the notion that that's enough or that a smart guy would go home and go to work. I don't recall ever entertaining any thoughts like that, and certainly not the behavior. When I started to drink, I didn't stop till I got stopped. I either had to hit the wall, get put in jail, and so I just had a long series of encounters with lots of trouble with just sort of strange behavior. Went to jail a great deal, psycho wards, where they'd put that. My behavior just seemed odd to people. It didn't to me, but it just seemed odd to people. And so they would occasionally put a net on me and put me in for deep study and analysis. And hospitals with stuff broken that I didn't even know had been injured. You know, and so it was just that kind of a wild, crazy type of a guy. And I think the lines of demarcation in that thing was that I started serious drinking when I was 16 years old. I believe I'd crossed that line into irretrievable alcoholism when I was 18 years old. Now, this is all hindsight and retrospect. None of it certainly was awareness at the time. But then when I look at that and I look at the course of that life, you know, here's a 16-year-old guy who starts out serious drinking at 16, and 8 years later, I'm living a kind of life that I swear to God, I didn't even know existed. I'm from Mayberry down in North Carolina, looks like. I'm a little peaceful town. We sometimes had to import a town drunk. You know, we just didn't have village idiots running around. It was just peaceful little old southern Mecca, you know. And so I grew up in that thing. And then in 8 short years, I'm living a totally bizarre lifestyle which would have at one time been totally unthinkable to me. Unthinkable. But it's amazing how subtle this thing called alcoholism sets in and what it does to a mind, eh? What it does to a mind. Because as I incrementally work my way from just a sort of an average-looking dopey kid through all of the slings and arrows of life, every time I would crash and hit the wall and start over, what I failed to recognize is every time I started over, I dropped down a notch, and dropped down a notch, and another notch, until I wound up living a totally bizarre lifestyle, and by the time I got there, it seemed like the only normal life for me. You know, there's a place, I think, that describes what I'm talking about very succinctly, as Bill was able to do so well, where he refers to conditions that we call illusions. You know, that illusion that somehow life is going to be different some sweet day. Remember how he spun that thing? And delusion. The inability to differentiate the true from the false. The inability to see my own behavior. And those were what my life was about, was that life of illusion and delusion. It's always interesting to me that you hear us, you hear us talking about denial a great deal. But we make that up because you won't find that in the big book. And I think the reason you don't find it in the big book is because it isn't an adequate term for the condition. Denial is essentially an intellectual tug of war between the closing in realities and that resistance, that denial. That's an intellectual kind of a process. Illusion and delusion go deeper than that. And I think better describe that thing. Because I'll tell you just one clear example of that thing. And I'll just give you one scenario, and you could multiply it 100 times, and you'd know a great deal of my story. After I got into the throes of alcoholism, and it became routine for me to wake up. I was a guy who had blackouts a great deal. It was routine for me to wake up in some god-awful situation. And I'll tell you, there is nothing more panicky in the annals of alcoholism than blackouts. They take on a little humor after about 10 years. But I'll guarantee you there is no humor in a blackout. When you come to and get that frantic feeling of where am I? And what have I done? And who am I? You never can be sure. Yeah, I woke up in the wrong place so many times that I developed, it was almost an art form of how to wake with no physical evidence of being awake. Because, you know what I mean? A lot of times if you wake up too suddenly, there'll be some yokel standing over you with a lot of rude, impertinent questions like, what are you doing here? Well, you hate to open a conversation by saying, where? I won't even get into it. Jeez, there's just hundreds and hundreds of those things. But they were all alike. I'll just tell you one. I came to up in Alaska. Well, I knew I was in Alaska. That was bad enough. Part of the reason I drank enough to be blacked out was that I was in Alaska. But I came to, and I was in a cot that wasn't mine. And it looked like a Cocker Spaniel. You know, a little woolly black Cocker Spaniel? Looked like a Cocker Spaniel in the bed with me. And I'm trying to push him out. You know, get out. I don't sleep with dogs. So I'm trying to, even drunk's got some standards. So I'm trying to push the thing away. And then when I came to, what I found was a silhouette burned in the mattress is what I was trying to push away. God looks after drunks and fools, eh? I had one blister on my soldier here. Nothing else. Yeah. That's mild. It ain't too mild, but it's fairly mild. I'll tell you one other thing in the same town that was a little bit different, and I will quit this in a minute. But I swear it's fascinating to me. I came to my senses one night, and I was in motion. And I was trying to fight with two guys. Well, I was doing pretty good, except, my firepower was good, but I couldn't keep my footing. You know, because every time I tried to swing, I'd knock myself down. I never did get to hit any of them. And but I was game. The guys I was fighting with were two fellas that, I don't know if they still do this or not, but in a railroad yard where they make up trains, you know, they put the car together and make up a train. Back in those days, they had two guys that walked in front of the locomotive to throw the switches so that the train would move properly. And that's the two guys I was fighting. They found me draped across the rails, head on one rail, feet on the other, and they're trying to pull me off. And I'm not sure who it is, but we're having a good time. And then it got clear. But, I mean, just on and on and on. And so I got so I could wake up and would just mentally come alive but not open my eyes. And would listen for the evidence. If I heard bars clanging, I knew it was okay. I was in the right place. Or if I smelled antiseptic, I knew they'd got me in a clinic or something. But it wasn't always that way. I came to one morning and I was in a bed. It wasn't mine. I knew it was much too nice. And I did that. I came alert, and I listened, and there was the maddest woman I think I have ever heard in my life in the next room talking to somebody about who is that drunken SOB in my daughter's bed. Well, my brilliant alcoholic mind concluded she might be talking about me. And so I've never been more still in my life. Man, I didn't even blink. I'm just laying there taut. And I'm frantically kind of peeking around looking for daylight so I can get out of there. Well, it wasn't as bad as it seemed. It was the house next door to mine. I only missed it one. My God, I usually missed it by a whole state or something like that. I thought I did pretty good. Well, those are terrifying things. And typically, when I would come to in whatever the latest mess might be, my response would be almost like you ran it off of Xerox. You've done it again. You've done it again. You're no good. You're worthless. You ought to just do yourself in. Why don't you just disappear? Just go away. Leave decent people alone. Those kind of moral whippings. You know, Bill wrote very, very clearly about that in some place in the book. Excuse me, Terry. Cooper costs a lot of money. You never know it, but it does. He wrote very clearly about that in a place about alcoholism where he talked about three words: pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And that's exactly what I felt every time I came to in the latest mess. And every time I did that, I would go through those things and then I would sort my options out. What do you do? Do you suck it up and go back and try again, or do you just disappear, or what? We have a simpler word for that. We call it bottom. Bottom's not a one-time thing. Bottom is a many-times thing. Because every time I came to in those conditions, I would reach out to the only solution I knew, and that was another drink. And so that was to be my life. I just sort of raced downhill, wound up in 8 years, from 16 to 24, just absolutely devastated my life, and unfortunately several others in the process, and did enormous damage. I wound up in the state of Michigan, a little south of Grand Haven. I woke up, that's where he's from. And I settled into a place called Flint. And Flint's a very nice little metropolis. It's sort of a resort area. If you're a refugee from Afghanistan, it might be a problem. It is bad news. I don't know why I went. I mean, I guess it's just a challenge. You know, why don't you go up there and see how bad it can be? That's where I wound up. Worked for a while, and then my reputation got in front of me, and I wound up unemployed, darn near unemployable. And I used to say that the last couple of years of my drinking, I live by my wits, but that's a little euphemistic for the way I live. I live by my lack of character. I know very little that a man can do that I haven't done. And I'm not proud of that, by any stretch of the imagination. You hear him believe this is no paradoxical macho deal. I am deeply ashamed of the way I lived. I wasn't reared to live like that. But by the time I got there, it seemed normal. Where I lived was in a jungle. And when you live in a jungle, you live by the laws of the jungle, or you don't live. It's just that simple. And so what I did during those periods, I really didn't consider criminal behavior. I mean, I don't know what you'd do if it was a crime, because if you call the police, it was as good a shot they would lock me up as they would whoever rolled me, because I probably rolled them the night before. And in a society like that, that's just the way it worked. You either roll somebody, you're getting rolled, and that was just what it was. It was a food chain in that environment. Never believed I would ever live like that. I existed by taking advantage of good-hearted people a lot. Had a lot of folks that really stuck their chins out and their necks out trying to give me a hand and trying to help me along. And how many of them I stuck it in the area just because that's the kind of guy I was. I wound up selling my blood $5 a throw. And I'm sure that I would have let them suck me dry if they hadn't had controls on people who were repeat customers too often. And so they had protection to protect people like me from myself. But I never believed I'd ever wind up like that. My most frequent address was either the street or a place called the Rialto Theater. I think if they ran a movie, it was the same one all the time. Didn't matter. That was the cheapest hotel in town. And so that's where I wound up. I'm confident I would have drunk myself to death. And a good many folk in here are well aware that, you know, I think among the most prevalent fears that alcoholics know are the fears of doing great harm to somebody else. I don't know of, I know a few alcoholics that I've ever gotten to know closely that didn't have enormous fears that they would do irreparable damage to somebody else. Most alcoholics don't want to do that. It's hard to tell by our behavior, but most alcoholics are really fairly decent people underneath. And I knew I was capable of anything, but I never, and I had great fears that I might do big harm, but I never really believed it. And so every time I would come to and go through the panicky feelings and breathe a sigh that nothing had happened and go back and do it again. But one morning, it turned out differently than that. I came to in jail, no novelty there. That was a common thing for me. And after I was awake for a little while, a jailer came by. I knew him well, and I said, "When can I get out?" And he said, "I hope never." And walked off. I had not a clue what he was talking about. And then he told me, not him, but some of the other guys in there told me that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city and had run down and killed two people. And I absolutely, I could believe it, but I couldn't handle it. You know what I mean? You know, that I don't understand much about the mind, but I understand this. The mind will only take in what it can handle. That explains a lot of behavior to me. And so my response was, no, that couldn't be. And the fact was, I just could not carry it away. And then gradually accepted the truth that I'd done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And where do you go from there? I was so deeply ashamed to be breathing. I didn't try to get out. I didn't try to figure out any way to get out of jail. It didn't matter to me if I ever got out of jail. In fact, I hoped I wouldn't. I could not fathom the thought of facing decent people. I felt deeply ashamed to be breathing when two fine young folks no longer were because of me. And I don't care how demented you might be. You don't balance those scales. There's no way. And so I sat in that place. And one of the policemen, for some reason, I guess he caught on to what I was doing and learned that I had family in North Carolina, contacted my folks, and my mother and sister made what was to be their last trip. Well, it certainly was my mother's last trip. It wasn't her first one, but it was her last one to get her little boy out of jail. She died 29 years later with a heart full of gratitude for a program that had given her a son for 29 years. And that day they came in and they got an attorney. They negotiated my release on bond. I was charged with manslaughter. Now, I knew. Now, I did not consider alcoholism in any serious way. I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I thought I was a young guy with a lot of potential. People had told me that. I thought I was a young guy with a lot of potential. One of these days, I'm going to get my feet on the ground and look out world. That's what I believed. And so I didn't believe I was alcoholic. But at the same time, you know, what I had done was commit a crime so horrible that there's no adequate punishment for it. There is none. And so the guilt was so great that I, honest to God, didn't believe it would ever be possible for me to ever take another drink. The guilt was too great. I just could not picture myself doing it. And I was released from jail on bond on the 17th of July. On the 18th of July, I was as drunk as any man has ever been. I didn't understand. That was probably the least likely time that I would have stopped, not the most likely time. And then from July to November of 56, I drank truly like nobody I've ever seen. That takes in a lot of people. I've worked with thousands and thousands of alcoholics. Never worked with one like me. And then I had, on the 19th of November of 56, was actually the date of what I hope and pray was my last drink. I don't celebrate my recovery till February 2nd is when I started in the program. That was just sort of a dazed kind of a period in there. There was no recovery to it. But that was the last drink. I finished a bottle of gin, went down to the court. It was no trial. I had no defense. You know, how do you defend yourself when you're in a blackout? What could you possibly do? You can't even testify at my own trial. You know, I'm not a witness to my own behavior. And so I was found guilty, of course, and sentenced to a max that day of 15 years, max of 5 to 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Well, I knew what that meant. I'd never been there, never visited the place, but there were a lot of guys on the street that I hustled around with that were in and out of there. So I knew it wasn't Disneyland by any stretch of the imagination. And so I had some notion. When that sentence was passed, I guess it was instinctive behavior. But I had an instinctive reaction of fear, just as real as could be. And at the same time, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. Not optimism or hope or new day or we'll find help. None of that. It was done. Done. And I walked into that place, resigned to my fate, never believed I'd ever come out of there alive. And I truly believe that that prediction would have been accurate were it not for what we celebrate here tonight. If it were not for Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think I would have ever come out of that cage alive. So I walked in. I was a beat up young fella. I was so into isolation that I didn't even pretend to connect with people, relate to people. I never had conversations with people. It put me in a cell, and all I'd do is sit in there and stare at my navel or read anything I could do to keep from thinking. And then one day, it's amazing how small the things are that constitute real turning points in life, eh? And if you think back, you'll find the same thing. Probably. And what happened with me that started to be the turning point that has given me a whole new direction in life from that day to this. I was interviewed one day by a fellow who worked there. He was a young graduate from one of the colleges, and he came over, got a job, and he interviewed me. Went through my case, and I tell you, anybody could have diagnosed me. You look at that record, it's all about drunk. And it doesn't take a rocket science to diagnose that, or Sigmund Freud. I mean, you could just tell by looking, this guy has some real problems. Everybody could see that but me. And so he got through with his interview, and he made the same diagnosis I'd heard every time anybody diagnosed me. Man, I've always heard, you're an alcoholic, you're a drunk, you've got problems with drinking. And this guy was no different. He says, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. He said, I never heard this before. Usually people would say, why don't you quit drinking? You know, something like that. And this guy said something I never heard. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution, and I think you ought to go. I never heard of that. I never heard of AA. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk. You don't help drunks. You hit them upside the head with a blackjack. That's what you do with drunks. What do you mean? And I never heard of it. It was a foreign concept to me. And I don't think he tried to explain it. I'm glad he didn't. The last thing I needed was some amateur trying to explain to me what it was. He didn't know. They taught him somewhere, if you get one with a record like that, it's about booze, tell me I ought to go to AA. And that's exactly what he did. You know the amazing thing? That was the first suggestion I ever heard. The first invitation I ever heard. And I've never looked back. I've never looked back. And it wasn't a defining moment. There was nothing significant about that. It was just two people 180 degrees apart. But he found a seed of common sense that somehow or other, miracle of miracles, started to connect. And sent me a little piece of paper a few days later and said you had to be on a list to go to AA there. Said you can go to your first meeting. Didn't say Groundhog Day, but that's what it was, February the 2nd of 57. And I didn't want to go to AA. I wanted to sit in that cell and not see anybody. I wanted to isolate. I wanted to hide. And I didn't want to go to AA. It wasn't that I was resistant to the program. I was resistant to engaging in life. And so the time came, and I went. And I think the only reason I went was I just didn't have any fight left. You ever been at places you were just beat? I mean, you just flat beat. I couldn't even muster an argument. And so I wandered in on Saturday afternoon, 1 o'clock, a school building. Big group of people. There was about 300 guys in that group. And when I walked in, there was one fellow spoke to me. Had an officer on the door. Ivester, yes, sir, sit down. So I sat down, sat in the middle of that 300. No earthly idea what to expect. I figured it was going to be kind of like a revival meeting or something. Yeah, I could just feel it coming. That, I mean, how you going to help drunks without singing Amazing Grace or something? I mean, I know you got to do something real churchy like it. I knew that was coming. I had left that before I started school and said I wouldn't be back. And so I had real, real antsy feelings about anything that was overtly religious. So I walked in, and sure enough, they said that prayer that we start off most of our meetings with, that serenity prayer. Ain't a real big prayer, but it's a big one if you don't want to hear none. You know, it was big to me. I figured they'll be in with the snakes any minute. And they read all that stuff we read. I swear sometimes we read everything but the newspaper. And so they read all that stuff. And then they introduced the speaker. And the guy got up from Kalamazoo. Kalamazoo. Home of Checker Cabs. And that guy told his story. Now, I'd heard drunks tell stories, but not their own. This had to be his story. Anybody gonna make that up? I thought, why is he doing that? I mean, my God, it didn't make sense to me to get up in front of 300 hair-legged convicts and undress yourself like that. And I thought, what on earth is he doing? Now, it made no sense to me. And when he got through, I didn't identify with one syllable of any word he said. He was as different from me as any person I've ever met in my life. And when I left the meeting, I knew probably less than I did when I walked in, and that was nothing. And the amazing, truly amazing thing to me is the next week I was back. And what brought me back was not identification, not a sense of community, not a sense of belonging, not a desire for a new life, not because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, none of that. The only thing that brought me back, I have no doubt, is that this guy who spoke was one of the most magnetically enthusiastic people I have ever seen in my life. He was the kind of guy that could not say good morning without being excited. And so when he told his story, it was just a rush of stuff, you know. And so what I got caught up in was that sort of invisible message, the spirit of the man. And so the next week I found myself back. It wasn't an irresistible urge pulling me against my will. I just found myself attracted back in. And that's what we do here, eh? That's what we do. We either attract new people into this way of life, or we repel them by how we handle them. And that's exactly what that guy did. He communicated something that even through my walls of resistance and denial and delusion, that got through, not in any conscious way, but I found myself back sitting in that chair again. Nobody would have missed me. Nobody would have come looking for me. Nobody cared. I'm just one more tragic face in a sea of tragic faces. But something happened, and a little bit of a spirit connected, and so I came back. I stayed in there 3.5 years, never missed a single meeting, you know, whether it was once a day or once a week, never missed a single one. But you can hurry up and believe I was not an instant convert. I was not somebody who caught the flash. I was not somebody who was popping high fives after 3 months. I have never felt more out of place anywhere in my life than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, certainly there was reason for that. I was the youngest guy in there. I think I was the youngest guy in the whole institution. They normally didn't keep people my age in that institution, but I think my history was just so wild and erratic that they figured I'd be gone if they ever gave me daylight. And so I stayed in maximum custody the whole time I was there. So I was certainly the youngest guy in the group by a number of years. Most of the guys in the group had drunk more years than I was years old. I'm 24 years old. And when you sit beside somebody who's drunk 40 years, you feel kind of wimpy sitting beside somebody like that. And so I didn't identify with them. I didn't feel any sense of belonging. I said I was an alcoholic because I hated to be the only one out of 300 that was something else. They all said they were. Me too. But it didn't mean a thing. And then gradually, I started to put together in my strange, rational way of doing stuff that it sounded to me like AA members said that when they drank, they got in trouble, therefore they were alcoholic. That's what it sounded like. I know that's not what they said, but that's what it sounded like. And I thought, my God, if that's what that is, I've had that all my life. Man, I've been in trouble all my life, never sober. I never married anybody I didn't know sober. Sure did drunk. Yeah, never went to jail sober. Never lost, well, I have lost cars. I'm losing cars more frequently now. But you know, if trouble's it, I've got it. But certainly there's more to it than that. And so I just kept going back. I was fortunate in that the recovery group in Jackson Prison, Maximum Custody Penitentiary, was as fine an AA group as I've ever seen. Excellent group. And what I mean by that, they understood the fifth tradition. They brought it to life. They used the fifth tradition like it was a job description. That our job is to carry this message to the new alcoholic who comes into our presence. And they did a great job of that. And I'm talking about other guys in the joint just like me. The only difference, they were ahead of me a bit. And what it was to me was a real example that you don't have to be one of the founders of AA to do effective work. You know, somebody who's gotten just a bit of something that's better than what he had can share something very effectively with somebody else. And so my first few weeks in the program, it was meeting in a separate group, going through the steps and listening to people really describe this program that they called a design for living. First time I ever heard that term. It had great meaning to me the first time I heard it, and it has every time since. That AA is a design for living. It's not some mystical kind of a thing that happens to a fortunate few. It's a very logical design for living that'll work for anybody that will take the actions that are laid out in this program the way they're laid out. It will work without any question. And so that's what I was given to believe, to understand it. It gave me a foundation. It gave me a fundamental grounding in the program. I certainly wasn't healed, but neither did I think I was in some magic show either. Now, I started to catch on that there really is a program here. And what the guy said was, there are 200 words in the 12 steps. If you'll take those things the way they're laid out, when you get through, you'll be a different guy. I took it with a grain of salt, but I took it. And so I went to work in the program. I got involved heavily in action. I've heard AA described as a group of alcoholics in action. And the recovery group at that prison was a group of alcoholics in action. I, honest to God, didn't know that there was an option to not be involved in service. Nobody ever asked me what I thought about it. The guys just said, come on, we're going over here and do this. And I just go on and do that. And it's amazing how that worked. I got caught up in stuff. I started to develop a sense of belonging. I started to feel a sense of shared purpose. I started to feel a sense of membership. I won't linger on it, but I'll just say this, that, you know, being a part of the team, having a sense of connection and belonging, feeling the fellowship, those are all good things. Having a real working knowledge of the program so that I understand what it is and it's not just some jumble of mystery, those are good things. But it takes more than that. It takes a solid grounding. I was a guy that was fumbling with the steps, and I'll just really grossly oversimplify. In hindsight, what I see and started to see dimly at the time was that the first three steps are enormously important in giving me a foundation from which I can recover. Admitting my hopelessness and unmanageability in the first one, coming to believe that a power, unnamed, that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Great message for me to understand that this program is not about getting good. This program is about getting well. If you get good, that's just too bad. I mean, that's the way it works sometimes. But a fundamental kind of sensible understanding that I'm somebody who's beat, there is hope. There is a power that can restore me to sanity in the decision to use that power. That's the foundation. My own humble personal belief is that it doesn't have a lot to do with recovery, but it has a great deal to do with survival. It has a great deal to do with building a foundation from which a new life can grow. Enormously important. And I don't demean that a bit, because I know people who have done those steps and no more nor ever pretended to who died sober. In this program, there is nobody who stamps it Haynes when you do a certain amount of work. In this program, you stop at what you're willing to settle for. I know people who settled for far less than me. They had maybe a simpler case, but I was not one of them. And so what I'd had to do and what I found, wound up doing, I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but one day, I want to talk about the next four steps, 4 through 7, just for a few minutes here. But those were fundamental things in solidifying and starting to put definition and real purpose into this thing called recovery. I did a fourth step almost by accident. A guy spent the whole meeting talking about it. When he got through with it, I went back to my cell. I sat down. I meant to write a little story about how tragic life was. and what a victim of circumstances I was. And it wasn't really my fault. I was really not this kind of guy. You know, that's what I meant to write. That made sense as long as I was just thinking about it. Founders were wise when they said, write the inventory. Because if you write yourself a lie like that, you really got some trouble. I sat down, started to write what I had in mind, very logical and coherent. I wrote two lines, and all at once it was as if I hit a wall. Now, there was no thud or anything. But all at once, the charade ended. That life of delusion and illusion cleared enough that I think I must have just seen, my God, man, that's stupid. And in one motion, without any real soul searching or deep reflection, in one motion, I just opened up and started to pour out my heart. When I got through, I had three pages of hopeless scribble. Nobody could have read it. Nobody's supposed to. That was my inventory. And I'll tell you this, without any question, that was the most important day's work this old boy has ever done, bar none. It wasn't a literary masterpiece, but it was the most important day's work I've ever done. Better, more important than the day I married, son was born, daughter, career, took retirement, whatever. Because everything else in my life suspends from that action that happened that day, because I was never the same man from that day to this, in this sense. When I got through with that, I knew that I was alcoholic, period. Period. Not the young one or the complicated case or the tragic case. I was alcoholic, period. Our book says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. That's not public business. That's private business. And I conceded to the depth of my soul that I'm beat. I'm not a guy who wised up and said, sober's better than this. I think I'll try it. Forget it. I'm a guy who accepted at depth. I'm a guy who can't drink for whatever reason. And fellow alcoholics, when that happened, that war was over. That war was over. And it will never be revisited again unless I start to consciously call into question that belief, or else I take a drink of anything with alcoholic, then all bets are off. But I have never doubted for one second that I'm alcoholic. No question. All that leaves me with is the mind of a chronic alcoholic. The book says that we're folk that the primary problem rests in our minds, you know, not in a body. That body will never bother me again. The fact that I'm alcoholic will never bother me physically again unless I do one thing that's an absolute no-no. I'll never know craving unless I take a drink. That fight's over. So that mind's what I'm left with. And so what the rest of the program is for with a guy like me is to start to understand what is it that drives my life in such a weird kind of direction. What is it that makes me wiggle and wobble and get into sort of screwed up relationship with people? Well, I won't elaborate on it, but I'll just say this, that I learned without any question, I didn't buy my alcoholism at a bar. And I didn't buy my screwed up life out of a bottle. You know, my screwed up life was the whole thing that drove the ship. We called those things defects of character. Early in my life, I had some things happen, and I reacted to them in a way so that I developed characteristics of how I deal with the world around me that are warped and out of whack. And I wind up hurting people almost automatically. And so the purpose of this inventory is to go back and start dealing with those things where I have done damage to other people, where my emotions or drives have been out of whack, and they've been enemies to me. And that's what that fourth step was about. That first one was a crude thing. Later on, I did a more thorough analytical inventory. But the second did not have the value of the first. That first one was the most important thing, crude though it was, because it's what got to that point of deep surrender. The other one gave me insight, and it put some sharpness to some things. But that was a tremendously important thing, opening it up to another person, And making the first crack in that wall of self-centered, fearful isolation that had been my entire life. First crack that ever appeared was when I did the first step with another human being. That person, when we got through, knew me better than my mother knew me. First human who ever got a look at me. And the first crack in that fearful kind of prison that I'd lived in all my life. Powerful therapy. And then 6 and 7 basically just comes down to, okay, buddy, you've seen it. You know what your alcoholism looks like now. You know what defects of character are they made. You know how what they do to your life. Do you want to change or don't you? Doesn't say it in those words, but it says we were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Am I ready to change or am I not? Do I want to work both sides of the street? Do I want to have it both ways? Or am I willing to make those dramatic changes? Tremendous thing. And then if I am, then I ask God. And then the rest of the steps, I always do them no justice, but the rest of the steps are about how to develop that new life. You know, the 8 and 9 I call the surgery of Alcoholics Anonymous, where my belief is this. It doesn't make it right, but it's certainly mine. My belief is this, that every time I screwed over, abused, misused, embarrassed, humiliated, any kind of person or an institution or whatever, I didn't win, I lost. And I paid for that with a piece of my soul. My belief is that I will never be a free man until I go back and make right those wrongs. I don't care how many people pat me on the head and tell me I'm a good boy, who pat me on the head and say, oh, I'm so proud of you. That has nothing to do with the gangrene of the soul that owns me. And so till I go back and make right those wrongs, I will drag that forever. And so that's what those steps are about, is to root those things out and to start dealing with those defects by starting to do the corrective actions that'll make me grow some character, that'll make me grow some principles and start to live a different kind of life. And then the rest of it's about putting it to work. Well, that was more than I meant to say about that thing, but that's enormously important to me. Because so many people get to 6 and 7, and rather than moving forward into what we're just talking about, what they'll basically do is spin off into what I call pit stop AA, where the CAA is a place to go get what I need and then get on with life. Just drop in and drop into some place where the meeting is the only purpose of the meeting. It has no life before or after. It's just a drop-in place where you get it and go. And if I opt to do that, my honest belief is that the quality of sobriety will be extremely short-lived and limited, and the quantity will be time-limited. That'll only last so long. And then you'll start hearing stuff like, oh, Jesus, is that all they ever talk about is gratitude? My God, Tom I speaking again. He was just here 10 years ago. He got... You know the stuff that I'm talking about. That's what you start to hear unless we become a real active vessel in carrying this message, carrying this life. Well, I finally got out of jail. That doesn't take a genius. It just takes a lot of time. And this program really started working for me in that institution. I'll just tell you this in a one-liner, but it's the God's truth. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, that's described as a reward in Alcoholics Anonymous that I wasn't given when I was locked up like a wild animal in a zoo. Locked up like a wild animal, and I experienced the first full day of freedom I'd ever known in my life. Joy, worth, self-esteem, none of those things had ever been part of my life, and they became mine in conditions that were absolutely impossible by anybody's standards. This is a powerful program. This is not a feel-good deal. This is about a new life, you know, where you can live with peace and dignity and honor no matter what your circumstances. And so I was deeply grateful for that. I was released after 3.5 years on condition that I go to North Carolina and not stay in Michigan. And I asked him to let me think it over. You know I did. And so I left. It was good. I had two things on my mind that I wanted to do. It's amazing what you get on your mind. So a lot of things I wanted to do, but the two uppermost in my mind, I wanted to get out of prison clothes. God, I wanted that. I spent every cent that I had on buying anything that didn't look like it had been issued by the keeper. and I looked like a circus clown, but I felt better. I got you. And I wanted a chocolate shake. Isn't that strange that that's what you'd be hankering for when you get, and got them both fairly soon. And then got immediately active in AA. The same day I was out, I was in a meeting that night and most nights thereafter. And I tell you that it's an amazing thing that happens with, when I left that institution, I had the little dreams that men have. I wanted to be physically free, of course. I wanted to be able to work and make an honest living for a change. Yeah, I wanted to have a friend or two. I wanted to be trusted sometime. I wanted to be a citizen. I never had been. Never paid taxes in my life. Never had to fill out an income tax form. I wanted to do stuff like that. Little stuff. Immediately active. I went to a prison the second week I was out to visit an AA group. 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of an AA group. Now, that's no big deal to just the average walking around person, but if you just walked out of a maximum custody joint and then you were a trusted servant 2 months later, going back into one, that's a big deal. And I was enormously grateful. My parole supervisor came to me and said, "You ought to be able to drive, boy." And I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't," as if he didn't know. 2 months with a crime like mine, and just a short while after that, I was restored driving privileges in the state of North Carolina through no action of my own. Yeah, what I believe is that when we give ourselves to this simple program and God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what those walls are. They come down. Elected DCM 5 months after I was out. I was a trusted servant for AA in 15 cities in my state. Marvelous, marvelous feeling of affirmation. 2 years after I was out, I was called one day from our state capitol. A man, I'd met him once. He visited the AA group that I sponsored at that prison, and he introduced himself. I remembered him. And he said, "Mr. Ivester, we're expanding a rehabilitation program in our prison." Said, "We were wondering if you would accept a position." And the first thing I said was, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And at that time, there had never been an ex-con in history hired into a prison system, and I knew that. And it had never entered, apparently, nobody else's mind either. But he said, "Yeah, we know who you are. We've checked you out." And of course they had. And he said, "We would like to have you come to work." And to him I said, up here, intellectually, "My God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I can think of." But deep down inside, you know what I said, there ain't no way. Ain't no way. But there was a way. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I was employed in 1961 as a rehabilitation officer in the state prisons in North Carolina. I was a sort of an ill-prepared guy. I don't know what, nobody ever told me what they were looking for. And I finished 2 years at Michigan State while I was locked up, not at Michigan State, but they sent it down on television. Somebody invented that while I was drunk. And so here they were. So I'd gotten 2 years, but I don't know why. Nobody ever did tell me why they wanted me. But anyway, I was employed, and all I did was give it my level best. Now, I'm not a professional ex-convict. In fact, I don't know of anybody that's in the market for ex-convicts. I don't know if anybody is recruiting for ex-convicts. And I know that I had some decision to make. There was nobody to talk it over with because I'm the only guy in that position on the planet, so I used AA traditions and AA friends to talk about the principles involved, because they're no different just because it was a unique situation. And so I went to work, and I was a professional. I was not some. I could have been a hoodlum hero and been on every scandal sheet in the country, but that's not my deal. So I took my place on the line as a professional, finished my education in correctional administration. I wasn't particularly ambitious, but I just gave it everything I had. And it's amazing what happens when you give it your best. There's a hunger for leadership. And I started getting pulled into supervision and management and program direction. And then one day, the head of our system asked me to come by, and he asked me if I'd take over an institution as warden. And I tell you, that to this day seems ludicrous to me. But but I didn't really want to. I finally said, "Yeah, okay, boss." And I did that for the next 20 years of my career. And so I spent the overwhelming majority of my career as a warden and correctional administrator. in leadership roles in our system. A phenomenal thing. It's a phenomenal thing of what God can do with the junk that he gives a new life. And finished up the career, I realized I was the oldest guy in the system. And so when I put in 39 years, I said, Jesus, may I ought to retire. People do that at this age. And so I retired. The next day, I had already been elected to be the chairman of AA Volunteer Work in Corrections. So my retirement was extremely short. And all I did was quit getting paid. But I'm still an extremely active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my old yearnings has been satisfied. I told you I started out as outside sponsor of a prison. Back in the secret recesses of my mind, I had looked forward to the day when I would be able to retire and be back sponsoring a prison AA group. And I do that today. It so happened the warden of the institution we're doing in corrections, and it's a real calling. I'm an extremely active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been as active as anybody I know for as long as anybody I know, and I am truly the most rewarded man that I know. Not only me, but my family. I know that many of you are involved in service, and when you're involved in service, you worry about the price you pay. How much impact does it have on the family? What does it do to the kids? What does it do to your job? I can tell you this for whatever it's worth. There is absolutely no important area of my life that has been less than richly blessed by my level of activity. What I find is that the principles of this program don't compete or conflict with the principles of my work or my marriage or my parenthood. If I'm practicing those principles, those things will find the balance. You know, the folks have done well. My wife and I just celebrated 36 years of continuous marriage. And my kids have done well. They worried me a little bit. My daughter went into psychology. I wasn't sure where she was going, but she's now managing a program for developmentally disabled people in several counties of our state, and is a wonderful leader, a good manager. My son is a high-risk physician. He decided to go into medicine and then went into OBGYN over my protests. And as if that weren't risky enough, he's now a high-risk physician at the University Hospital in North Carolina. As I'm extremely proud of those folks. What I'm trying to say by that is that extreme levels of activity of this program, if it's principle-based, will not do harm. Those folks have been richly blessed. And I'll guarantee you AA is important in their lives, and they've had the chance to succeed in their own lives. So, having a great time. I've closed with this one little thing. Somebody sent me something on an email that kind of describes the way I look at life. It's talking about some guy that got a hit in a ball game. It's talking about how you wanted to go out when you died. And the fellow said the way he wanted to go out, he wanted to hit that ball, and he wanted to chug around first base, and then chug around second, and then third, and then he wanted to slide into home, sweaty and dirty and maybe even a little bloody. And as he slid in, he wanted to say, "Holy moly, what a trip." That's me. Thank you.